have let them down. I have let my country down. And I have let myself down.
Did you ever take banned substances to enhance your cycling performance?
Yes.
Yes or no? Was one of those banned substances EPO?
Yes.
Did you ever blood dope or use blood transfusions to enhance your cycling performance?
Yes.
Hi everyone, and welcome to Backstory. I'm Dana Lewis. Oh, how the mighty have fallen. The first one you heard was American track and field star Marion Jones, who won 3 gold medals and 2 bronze medals at the 2000 Summer Olympics in Sydney, Australia, but was later stripped of her medals after admitting to steroid use. And she lied to investigators, so was jailed for 6 months. Some never admit it, like 7-time winner of the Tour de France, Lance Armstrong. He denied doping for years and was finally cornered with undeniable evidence and came clean. But not before he attacked the World Anti-Doping Authority Chief Richard Pound, saying Pound's allegations of doping in cycling, and against him, was just the latest in a long history of ethical transgressions and violations of athletes' rights by Mr. Pound. But Armstrong was proven to be a cheater, and Pound's integrity as an official determined to root out cheating grew in stature. Now, I covered 5 Olympics for different news organizations, and along with the glory of victory and the flag waving and gold medals were the scandals at every Games. And the scandals in between the Games, as athletes were spot-checked and found to be cheating with performance-enhancing drugs. And always in the background, driving the movement to clean up sport, was Canadian Richard Pound. On this Backstory, we hear from the man who first drove the drug cleanup effort in the International Olympic Committee and then formed and guided the World Anti-Doping Authority that governs sports around the world to make cheaters pay. And most importantly, protect the athletes who want to compete clean. Richard Pound has just retired. All right, Richard William Duncan Pound is a Canadian swimming champion, a lawyer, a prominent spokesman for ethics in sport, and he was the first president of the World Anti-Doping Authority and vice president of the IOC, the International Olympic Committee, and he joins us from Montreal. Hi, Richard.
How are you today?
I'm good. I'm very happy to see you. I haven't seen you in person, I think, since 2008 in the Beijing Olympics, but we've talked since then on some of the scandals in sport. There have been many.
I'm afraid so.
In 2005, I didn't realize that Time magazine named you one of the world's 100 most influential people, and they wrote, Pound, it's an appropriate surname for the head of the World Anti-Doping Agency. Then again, so would be harass, rebuke, scold, and generally makes a pain in the ass of himself, although the latter would look awkward on a business card. Was that flattery? Were you happy to get that?
Oh, well, you know, Time magazine has its style.
Why do people cheat? That's the first question I want to ask you.
They want to win, and they don't really care how they win, and they don't realize that when they cheat, they don't really win. But anyway, it seems to be a feature of the human psyche.
I mean, you were a great sports and are a great sports enthusiast. You were a competitor. And then suddenly you found yourself being channeled towards policing doping in sport. Is that a turn you wanted to take?
Well, it's certainly one that I never anticipated. And when it happened, I remember as the World Anti-Doping Agency was being created, the IOC president of the day said, Leeson Deek, you must be the president of this. And I said, but wait, I don't know anything about doping. I've spent all my time in the IOC doing the television negotiations and the marketing program. And I said, aside from which I'm half dead from this Salt Lake City investigation. And he said, he was unmoved. So I finally said, all right, well, how about if the deal is when it's up and running in a year or so, I can get out? Yes, yes, yes.
What year was that?
They lie. It took me 9 years to get out.
Yeah. So that was Juan Antonio Semeranch, right?
Right.
I mean, you were first. I mean, it's worth mentioning that you were the first guy to negotiate television rights with the IOC and the networks, which became billions and billions of dollars. You probably had no idea what you were getting into then, but you certainly had no idea what you're getting into when it came to doping and sport. And why did you do that? I mean, why did you pursue and continue on? Because there must have been many moments where people came to you and said, you're sullying the name of this athlete, you're dragging down track and field or cycling or whatever the sport scandal of the day was.
I guess to some degree, it probably goes back to being a competitor. And as a competitor, I never liked to lose. Sometimes I was a sprinter. So if you make any kind of mistake, you're toast. You got to get everything right. And sometimes you hadn't prepared well enough and whatever it may be. You could live with that. I didn't like it. You try to learn from losing, but I never liked being cheated. And I don't think that that's an additional risk that athletes should have to take. So one of the deals in sport is you don't take certain substances. You don't use certain techniques. That's part of the rules. And if you cheat, that's not good. So I was always, the calculus seemed to me fairly easy. Either you followed the rules or you didn't. And if you didn't, I mean, there are all kinds of rationalizations, you know. Oh, I'm just trying to level the playing field because there are other people that are cheating and so forth. And say, no, you're not. You're actually trying to win. And if you find out that I'm taking 5 milligrams of whatever this prohibited substance is, you don't take 5. You don't want to tie with me. You're going to take 10 because you want to win. And I find out you're taking 10, so I take 20. And this sort of escalates to the point where the dosages become toxic or even lethal. So there's a health issue in it. And then there's the ethical issue, which is, but you promised to follow the rules that we all agreed on. And you just made a unilateral decision to breach them. And that's not right. And you should there should be consequences to that.
And how much blame do you put on the people around them, the coaches, the people who are promoting sport for money?
I think a lot, far more than half the blame goes there. I mean, some of the athletes that aren't even of full age when they're put on these programs. I mean, if you remember the East German programs back in the 60s and 70s, it was the things they were doing to these young athletes, particularly female athletes, because the steroids were much more effective on them than they were on the men. It would make if you were an ethicist, it would make your hair stand on end.
Yeah, and that's the era you grew up in, because when you were competing, the East Germans, that program, and then the Soviet program was probably at its height, without talking about Sochi yet.
Well, it actually, when I was in the Olympics in 1960, there were no rules, no sport rules. There may have been, general principles of law, with respect to certain drugs, but I mean, not anabolic steroids or things like that. In Rome, we knew that the weightlifters had been doing this for years. So we knew that it had spread to the weight events in track and field, like shot put, discus, and so forth. And everyone was very open about it. They said, what are you taking? And how much of this? Oh, well, he said, what is it? Just say, look at me. The figures have changed from sort of beefy guys to athletes who are really cut. And he said, look at me. My body shape has changed. I'm covered with acne and I'm in a terminal rage all the time. And my testicles are the size of jelly beans. But can I ever throw the shot? Much better than I used to. Instead of 60 feet, I'm throwing at 70.
That was the cliche, those big Hungarian shot putters or weightlifters, right?
Yeah, not just Hungarian, but there were a lot of them. And so what happened in the start of we're getting to where we are today is during the cycling road race in Rome, those same games, a Danish cyclist died in part because of taking a whole bunch of amphetamines. And the old guys on the IOC, they were only guys in those days, said, you're not supposed to come to the Olympics and die because of drugs. You're supposed to come and have fun. So they formed a medical commission with a doping and biochemistry subcommission, and the subcommittee was said, figure out what the athletes are taking, and you know which things in particular are dangerous as well as performance enhancing, and let's put together a list. So they put together a list, and you know, in fairly short order, given an international context. And the IOC started testing at the Olympics in 1968 in Grenoble, and have tested ever since. And that was the only testing that was really being done at the time. And the international federations, filled with their own organizational testosterone, said, well, no, during our events, we'll do the testing. They didn't do any. But the IOC was not allowed to test other than during the Olympic Games. And it took years and years and years for the IOC pushing and pushing and pushing to get international federations to do testing, which they did reluctantly, but only at their world championships. You had this system where, you know, for 3 years and 11 months out of every 4 years, the only testing really being done was by the IOC at the Games. And so it's fine. Race day drugs, you can detect. But if you've been on a steroid program and you're smart enough to get off it a couple of months before the Olympics, all the metabolites are out of your system, but you've got the benefit of a steroid program. And so the next step was to get out of competition testing.
Out of competition testing and random testing during the year.
Yeah, or even targeted. You know, the cyclist who's coming 300th in the peloton, who cares? But what we were finding was that it was the best athletes that were those at the highest risk.
Sorry to interrupt then. How did that morph then from the IOC doing the testing during the games and then out of the games when people were training during the year, world competition? How did that morph then into the World Anti-Doping Authority, which became very independent of the Olympic movement? I mean, you're part of it in terms of the testing, administering the testing, but in terms of the WADA became very independent and legally independent, correct?
Right. And that was the whole purpose of it, because what gave rise to the immediate cause was the Festina scandal during the Tour de France in 1998. While in France, there were French laws about possession of some of these things, and the French police found athletes and officials on the Festina team with industrial quantities of doping substances and the equipment to administer and so on, and they were arrested and put in jail. And that was suddenly, you know, if it doesn't happen in Europe, in a very Eurocentric Olympic movement, it doesn't really happen. So that's why the Ben Johnson thing 10 years earlier in Seoul, I was on the edge of the world somewhere, and it wasn't real because it was, it wasn't a European, and B, it was in Korea.
Ben Johnson was our Canadian sprinter who tested positive at the Seoul.
That was Ben. Ben Johnson, yeah. Oh, yeah, no, and so I was a little naive on that. I thought, well, maybe the message will get out to people around the world that, you know, at the Olympic Games, no matter who you are, no matter what extraordinary performance you've put in, even if you're in the number one sport in the Olympics, if you cheat, you'll be disqualified. As a deterrent, I thought that was going to work. So it wasn't, to say, until you get to Europe, in a sport really popular in Europe, and the blue ribbon event in that sport, the Tour de France, that all of a sudden some of these presidents said, ooh, if it could happen to cycling in its number one event, it might happen to my sport. So they started to think about that. And the IOC executive board, I was on the executive board at that point. We had a kind of an emergency meeting because unfortunately our president made one of these things that comes back to bite you. He's sitting in his hotel room in Lausanne, watching, you know, the arrests and stuff of the Festina officials and team members. And he sort of shook his head. He says, you know, for me, that's not doping. Doping is only if you can prove that it's dangerous to the health of an athlete.
Wow. Who was that?
This was Samaranch.
That was Samaranch.
And so, which is a perfectly defensible philosophical position, if you like, other than it was 180 degrees from what he'd been saying as president of the IOC. And he's forgotten that he's got a Spanish journalist in his room who's been given this rare opportunity to spend a day with Juan Antonio Samaranch and see how he runs the world of sport and he can't believe what he's hearing. So he's taking notes. There were no strictures on him. And in the next day, the El País or La Vanguardia
headlines,
IOC president not serious about doping, that sort of thing. It was a media firestorm, which led to an emergency meeting of the IOC executive board. So we get to Lausanne, and so he says, "Well, what are we going to do?" And we're all looking at each other, saying, "We, we're here because what you did." Anyway, he already knew that. So our conclusion was, look, you can't depend on cycling or any other sport to make sure its athletes are clean. You can't depend on France or Germany or Canada to make sure its athletes are clean. And the IOC itself is too weak to control the Olympic movement. So what do we need? That's the diagnosis, the prognosis. We need an independent, international anti-doping organization that is not controlled by any particular stakeholder. And I said, as it happens, we have kind of a model that could be adapted for such an organization, which is the Court of Arbitration for Sport, which the IOC had created, I think, back in 1984. And it was made up then of equal representation from IOC, international sports federations, national Olympic committees, and Olympic athletes. Said, now, that's not going to be enough here because we need, the world of doping is a little more specialized. But if we added two blocks to that, one being governments, and they said, why governments? Well, in sport, we know who the athletes are. We know what they're likely to be taking. We know who the bad coaches and so on are. But we don't have any power to enter premises and seize evidence of doping. We don't have the power to compel somebody to give evidence under oath. Governments have those kind of powers. Okay. And then I said, we need a sixth block. We need a major event organizer. We need somebody with coaching experience. We need to get somebody from the pharma industry to help us with the technical stuff. And so that resonated. And they said, all right, well, let's see if we can do something. And we have to have, we need a world conference on doping because we got to get all of these stakeholders to come together and agree that an independent anti-doping organization is the thing to do. And so we called for a first conference in, I think it was late January of the following year, 1999. And we're proceeding towards this first world conference. Then the doo-doo hit the fan with the Salt Lake City kind of improper conduct investigation, which was another firestorm. And I remember Sam Rice says, maybe we shouldn't have this conference right now in the middle of all this. And I said, what I'm talking about, we'll get out of Salt Lake somehow. But doping's too important. We've got to get hold of this because there's a certain momentum right now. Okay. So anyway, sure enough.
And they had to be seen to be acting, right?
Yeah. The IOC.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, if you're going to assert yourself to be the leader of the Olympic movement, you got to, from time to time, you got to lead, not just follow. And so, sure enough, if you had 15 minutes to speak at this conference, the first five were spent telling the IOC what a dreadful organization it was, and how the sooner it would vanish from the face of the earth, the better everything would be. But then they got down to focusing on this. And from out of this conference came a resolution that we establish what has now become WADA. And that's when, Samraj said to me, you must be the president of this. And I said, we get to the first conference, which I'm chairing because I'm now the president of WADA. We get this consensus with some difficulty because the governments threw a complete collective tantrum. And they said that, this is outrageous. We're going to leave. We're leaving the conference. If we don't have more than 50% of the control in the hands of governments, we're out of here. And I said, well, let's have a coffee break. I went to Sam Ranch, said, Antonio, they don't like my organogram. He said, I told you we should never have had this conference. I said, no, actually, their idea is better than mine. He said, what do you mean? He said, well, listen, if they have 50%, because they're not going to get more than 50%, give them 50% control, they're actually going to have to do something, not just sit on the side and carpet the sports movement. And secondly, if they have 50% of the control, they can damn well pay 50% of the costs. So I'm going to go back and talk to him. So I'm go back to this room seething with 35 or 40 sports ministers. I say, you don't like my model? No, you hate it. You really insist on 50%? Yes. I said, you've got it.
You got it.
I said, what?
You own it. You own it now, and you're in the soup with us, right?
You got it. And they said, no, it's a much better idea. I said, there are only two things. This is a serious problem. We don't have the luxury of you guys proceeding at your normal glacial pace to get anything done. We've got to be in the field January 1st of 2000 to start testing before the Sydney Games. Okay. And I must say, to give credit where credit is due, they got it done by November. I said, the second thing is, if you got 50% of the control, you've got to absorb 50% of the costs. Oh, well, you've never seen such hand-wringing in your life. All these governments arguing about their share of what would have been $4 million. We have, you know, our
That's annual, how many governments?
There were about 150 governments at the time. And I said, come on. And they said, well, fine. I said, well, I'll tell you what. We'll pay the IOC, we'll pay the first 2 years. But you, by the start of year three, you've got to find a way to pay your share. And again, I must say, to give credit where credit is due, by 2000, 2001, they had a continental formula.
So just to make this really clear for people to understand, I mean, the Court of Arbitration of Sport became the judge and the jury, and WADA, the World Anti-Doping Authority, was really the prosecutor, the organization that went and investigated and collected forensic sampling and presented it to the court. Is that right?
Partly. This is pretty primitive at this stage. So I'll give you an example. We got this set up, and we start early 2000. To do out-of-competition testing, only on the summer sports, because we were focusing on Sydney. And we found that an overwhelming percentage of the international sports federations did not even have rules that allowed them to test their athletes out of competition. A bombshell for me. And I was very naive. I thought all the things they were saying were true. You know, that they believe in clean sport and all that sort of stuff. They're just total lip service. So we spent the first number of months helping them put in place rules that allowed them to do the out of competition testing. That was the state of things. The Court of Arbitration for Sport, CAS, was never part of WADA. It simply was the recourse that was available if somebody did not think he or she should have been handed consequences for doping. And you could file an appeal, and that was decided on legal grounds.
So now there's a controversy about funding, right? Because the United States, as I understand it, they've been harsh critics of WADA, and WADA's been harsh critic of the Americans, arguing that they should not sign up to funding WADA anymore, or what is the main crux of the argument?
The main crux is the United States suddenly deciding that all of the problems in the world are WADA's, not their own. And the part of the foreign policy on the previous administration was, it was okay to do an indoor hammer throw whenever you didn't like what was going on. And so one of the things they said, well, we're not going to pay our agreed upon share of the WADA costs. And we said, but you can't do that. They said, yes, we can. And if you criticize it, we will regard that as a direct attack on the United States of America. It doesn't really follow, because you've just made an unprovoked attack on WADA by refusing to pay your share of the money you promised to pay. This is something you agreed to as the United States.
But what is the point of control, Dick? Like, what do they want to control?
It's not really clear what they want. That's part of the problem. They just say WADA needs to be reformed. Okay, how do you want it reformed? Well, you've got to have different governance. Okay, what are your suggestions? They don't have any. You've got to have more athletes on. We've already got athletes on WADA. They have the same representation that the 50 or 60 international sports federations have, and that the now 206 national Olympic committees have. It would not be fair to have any more.
So you were, quoted then as saying, we'll have to wait and see, but at some point, if the U.S. becomes a rogue state, I think we will start looking at whether the games in Los Angeles should proceed. If they are not performing their obligations under the convention and they're trying to destabilize not only the structure but funding of WADA, that's not acceptable behavior. And maybe the IOC, as I understand, you went on to say, maybe the IOC says to America they can't compete, they become a rogue state.
Part of the deal in sort of within the Olympic movement is you have to be compliant with the World Anti-Doping Code. One of the measures you would have to attract attention would be to make failure to pay your share of the agreed upon costs the equivalent of an anti-doping rule violation. And if you have an anti-doping rule violation, you're no longer eligible to participate in international sport, not just the Olympic Games. So that the way that, you know, that Russia will be unable to participate as Russia for the next couple of years. So that's one of the things you can do.
All right.
What I hope is that this rogue state mentality fades into the background, which is where part of the deal was, it was like a United Nations, one country, one vote. U.S. says no. We're paying far more than Haiti is, so we should have more votes. He said, but that's not the deal. Well, that's the condition we have.
This sounds like Trump and NATO, to tell you the truth.
Well, it does. It's been festering for a while. We think a lot of it emanates from the United States Anti-Doping Agency.
Russia. I mean, people don't realize that in 2014, Russia ran a state-sponsored doping operation where essentially they were preparing cocktails, giving them to athletes, smuggling urine out a back door of the facility where these urine samples were supposed to be held secure. So there you have a state that is supposed to be helping WADA make sure its athletes are clean. And they're just completely upending the entire regime of anti-doping. I mean, and it goes on, right? I mean, they are still banned because even after there were whistleblowers, after the revelations were made as to what they were doing with the FSB, the security services that were helping them, they were then supposed to come clean on sampling, and then they didn't do that either. So they are perpetually banned right now.
Well, not perpetually, but certainly their national anti-doping organization is. Their lab has been suspended. It's an evolving story here, but until 2015, all our stakeholders, international federations, the IOC, everybody, they did not give WADA the power to conduct investigations. We could rely on other investigations. We couldn't conduct our own. Think about that. A lot of folks didn't want an independent international anti-doping agency looking over their shoulder in what many sports were very cozy arrangements regarding doping. So the first one regarding Russia came about as a result of the Stepanov's expose on German television at the end of 2014. So the
right. These are the whistleblowers who fled to the United States later on, one of them was a coach, and one of them was an athlete, and they laid out exactly what was going on in Sochi.
Right, I remember. I mean, they had tried to give WADA some of this information, but we couldn't do anything with it because we weren't allowed to investigate. So, I chaired the first investigation. It was limited to Russia only, and to athletics. Track and field only. So we reported on that at the end of 2015, saying the system, as it affected track and field, was totally corrupt. But there were two loose ends that we didn't have, and they weren't really necessary for our report on it. One was the FSB. The FSB is present regularly in the Moscow laboratory. And we said, well, what is the Russian state interest in stale urine provided by athletes? That was a kind of a does not compute. The other was reports of athletes coming with brown paper bags with containers of urine and depositing them at various sport. Say, what's that all about? Is this kind of secret testing to see what their clearance times might be on a steroid program or what? didn't know, but we made the observations. The subsequent investigation by Richard McLaren put those ends together. The FSB was there because they were involved in the substitution of samples given by Russians in competition, pouring that stuff out, replacing it with clean urine, the paper bag stuff, which had been frozen and kept for just this kind of an occasion where the Russian athlete was tested in competition and would have been bounced except for the switching of the urine.
So they cannot participate in Tokyo. So years, decades after you started all of this, isn't it a bit dark to you that probably what was a few athletes cheating or a few hundred or maybe a few thousand throughout the whole Olympic movement with their individual coaches became almost like where you began back in East Germany, not you began, but where all of this controversy began with the pharma labs in East Germany, state sponsored. I mean, it seems like we haven't gone forward. We've kind of gone where?
Well, one of the things we've done is we've turned over the rocks and now people have at least a better idea that this stuff is going on and that it's not here and there. You know, in cycling, they used to say, peloton is clean. And then despite themselves, they found that was an outlier. That person's gone. Now the peloton's clean. And, you know, it just went case by case like that. So, but there's no, it's certainly double digits in terms of a percentage. And we're getting better at it. And we've got, you've got out of competition tests. You've got, you can find very small quantities. So you can get athletes that are coming off a program and there's very little traces left of the stuff they've been taking. But now we can find it. We keep Olympic samples for 10 years now. And so as the knowledge of science and the knowledge of what's been being used expands.
Because it's always a cat and mouse game where they use masking agents and different things and they figure your testing will never find this. But if you hold it for 10 years, that's a long way. And then you go back and strip medals from athletes.
Absolutely. And that's, in a sense, if you think about it, that's probably a more devastating outcome for athletes than being caught on the competition day and saying, they got me. It's a fair cop. I'm out of here. But, 10 years later, you finished your career. You've got a family. You've got a job. You have a reputation in your country. And you're exposed as that being all false. It's,
Do you support calls for tougher punishments like jail time for athletes? And, some of the American debate is that they just don't suppress doping, but they rid sport of it with, very tough measures, including jailing. I mean, Marion Jones, the sprinter, went to jail, but not very many people go to jail.
Well, she went to jail not for doping. She went to jail for lying to the FBI. And I philosophically, if you cheat, I don't want to play with you. I just, go away. But to go to jail, no. If you're part of the organization of it and you're supplying steroids and you're subverting sport generally as an official, that's a different thing.
If you were just to very quickly bullet point, tell me which sports you think you've really brought under control and made progress in, and what are the ones that are going to be the tough ones in the future, what would they be?
Well, certainly weightlifting has proven to be very tough. And drug use is endemic. Track and field has got a big problem. I don't think cycling has solved its problem. Swimming has an increasing problem. There's no sport where you are without risk.
China, there are calls for boycott in their upcoming games. Sorry, what year is it? It's 2022 is the winter game.
Basically less than a year from now.
Yeah, because if Tokyo was pushed back a year, Tokyo looks like it may go forward. We'll have to wait and see with this pandemic. But on China, I remember reading, and we sort of end where we began, when I read your book right before I did an interview with you in Beijing, you were not a big fan of the boycotts that took place with the Soviet Union, and then the Soviets then boycotted 4 years later in Salt Lake City, right?
In Los Angeles,
Los Angeles.
No, I don't think I don't. First of all, I don't think they're effective. Secondly, if you fast forward to Beijing, it's a little bit like your government saying, "We're so mad at you, China, for suppressing the human rights, civil rights of some groups of your citizens, that you know what we're going to do to show you how annoyed we are? We're going to take away all the rights of our own athletes and put them metaphorically in jail at home to show you what dreadful people you are." And do you really think that's going to bring about conduct change in China? No, of course it's not. And we have a view, however aspirational it may be, that sport can help create a better world. You can, with the Olympic Games, you can show that it is possible, even if it's only a 2-week or 1-month bubble, for 206 countries to live together, play together, work together, have common goals, free of discrimination, all that sort of stuff. It is possible. And that's, I've always thought that's one of the reasons why, to go back to doping, a doping case at the Olympics is regarded as so serious, because it destroys that aspirational goal. People in professional sports, nobody cares. These people are regarded as gladiators, and what they do to get ready for their sport, that it's up to them. It's entertainment solely. But this aspirational international side of things is I think some good can come from it. And it's not going to be there's no silver bullet, and it's not going to be a sudden gestalt. But bit by bit, persisting with that view, and insisting on doping controls and all the things that go with it, it can do something.
Richard, great to talk to you, and I've always been a big fan of yours. I think you've been a great lightning rod for ethics and morality and sport, and you've never pulled any punches, and you're known for being forthright and shooting straight from the hip, and great for you. Good for you. It's great to talk to you.
Thanks very much.
And that's our backstory on Richard Pound and WADA, the World Anti-Doping Authority. This struggle to clean up sports, as you already know, is endless. But I guess it's like street crime. You catch the bad guys and gals, make them pay, but there's always another waiting in the shadows ready to do anything to steal. In this case, it's a stolen victory from another athlete who should have medaled and was squeezed out by a cheater. If you like Backstory, share it, and I've now started a newsletter on what is news and what I think is worth reading, because a lot of people are confused as to what news sources to tap into today. That newsletter is on danalewis.substack.com. And please sign up to this podcast if you haven't already, and thanks for listening. I'll talk to you again soon.